if your deadline does not seem literally impossible,
it's
then
too much.
It's then it's way too conservative. Mm-hmm. If your deadline seems reasonable, here's a good acid test. Go to an industry expert. So if you're doing a hard tech startup, mm-hmm. go to an industry expert and tell him your timeline. If he doesn't like gawk at you and like hang up the phone, then your timeline is not aggressive enough. Because that is the only way that incredible technology moves forward.
Hello, I'm Ty Morse. Welcome to Relentless. This is my conversation with Isaiah Taylor, the founder of Valor Atomics. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So your great-grandfather was a top nuclear physicist on the Manhattan Project at Oak Ridge.
That's right.
Developing advanced nuclear prototypes. What was the most interesting story your grandfather told about his time at Oak Ridge?
So my great-grandfather died when I was pretty young, but my great-grandmother lived until just a few years ago. And I actually have on my Apple Watch, before she passed away, I would sit down with her at the breakfast table. You know, we'd drink some coffee, and I would just click record on my Apple Watch. And she would start talking. Some of my most prized possessions, for sure. Hearing about living at Oak Ridge and the secrecy around what they were doing was pretty incredible. Having a town of, I think it was 80,000 people by 1945, and hardly anybody knew.
And this was like out of nothing a few years earlier, right? Or was this similar to Los Alamos?
So the timeline here is nuclear fission was discovered in 1938. 1939, Einstein co-authored a letter to the president saying, like, this is probably going to be useful for the bomb, maybe. In 41, Roosevelt sort of green-lighted the atomic bomb project. The land was purchased later that year, just this random, you know, strip of woods in Tennessee. And, you know, nobody around, just this ridge. So they purchased it in 1941, started construction late 1942. People started moving in, like, January, February 1943. That's when my great-grandfather moved up there. And the bombs fell in 45. So they basically had like a year and a half to 2 years of solid work in there. Just breakneck speed of development. It's just unbelievably fast timelines for something that had literally just been discovered 4 years earlier. It's insane.
Do you know how they were able to achieve that with like the bureaucratic, you know, structure of the government
kind of
lording over them?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So I think that there have been like different eras of how Americans have built things, and there was a time when the bureaucracy of government was just firing on all cylinders, like the Apollo program and the Manhattan Project, and even like the highway system and things that were built in that era. There was this sort of like top down bureaucratic, lots of money, lots of people getting shit done incredibly fast, I think that type of system takes just a lot of national spirit. It takes a lot of cooperation and, you know, just culturally, like everybody mostly believing the same things and believing in their nation. And wartime certainly helps that. Like, you know, there's nothing like a war that kind of everybody knows which side everyone's on, mm-hmm. to just like all get together and get something done. We seem to have left that era. There was another era after that, which was unfortunately sort of like a financialization era, where the government was not as dynamic. It was still funding things, but there was sort of that first generation of sort of builders and leaders who passed it on. And, you know, the generation after that maybe didn't have as much practical building experience. Things slowed down, got mired in all sorts of, you know, it was always mired in politics. Like, you know, the Apollo program directors were constantly fighting Congress tooth and nail on every single thing. So it's always been politics. But you know, there was just an American spirit that everybody shared. Now I think things have to be a lot more privately driven. Mm-hmm. There's still absolutely an opportunity for massive, like, collective organizations. But those organizations tend to be, you know, driven by like one individual who's generally a private individual, and he will go and collect resources around him, which will include government resources for sure. But certainly
driven by private enterprise.
Yeah. And generally one guy, like one mm-hmm. individual, Elon, who goes in and just says like, yeah, we'll get this government money, but didn't really, you know, the motivation, the impetus didn't come from a government project. It comes from one guy like, yeah, it's time to do this thing.
Yeah. Okay, so when you were a kid, my understanding is your parents put basically two things in your room, like a set of Legos, and then a 20-volume, what was it?
Yeah, the Encyclopedia of Science Science and Technology. So there were two of them. There's three. There's a set called How It Works that I don't remember anything about the publishers of any of these three, but that one was like much more illustrated. And then there was the Illustrated Encyclopedia of Science and Technology, which were sort of thinner volumes, and they were kind of a mid-range where lots of like prose, but then also a fair amount of illustration. And then there's like the big, thick Encyclopedia of Science and Technology, which had basically no illustrations, and it was just dense either math or engineering data. And I had all three sets, sort of bottom shelf, mid shelf, top shelf. And I think I spent most of my time in the middle one, the one that had a good union. But it was really cool because it was sort of like pre-Wikipedia, but like a significantly more, I don't know, vetted, filtered, whatever you want to call it. The problem with like the internet is when you're looking at an encyclopedia, like a lot of people have thought about what should be in that and what should not. You get like this crazy density of like important information, because if it's going to get into the encyclopedia, it has to reach a level of like importance. But it has the same structure where you can like look at a topic and then you can double click on that, sort of like clicking the Wikipedia link. You can go and look at where that topic is discussed. So if you want to understand radar, you can start at like the, you know, TRL-8 level and say like, okay, this is like a commercial technology, and it'll describe how it works and describe the subcomponents. But then you can like double click on them and be like, wait, what is the actual physics here? Like, what is a radio wave? And then you dig into like, well, okay, what is actually the science on like light and like particles versus waves and this kind of stuff? And the big thick volume will have everything, and you can drill all the way back down. And I think that's kind of where I learned to think of technology as like a composition of things that you can understand and should understand all the way down. I didn't even know at the time like whether or not to like think about something as like electrical engineering or as a discipline, or think of it as mechanical engineering or chemistry, you know, chemical engineering. I just saw sort of like a technology, and then I wanted to understand all the stacks underneath it. So my children will absolutely have that in their rooms as well. I think it's very, very valuable. And I love Wikipedia surfing too, but there's just something about like the constrained scope of like somebody thought about everything that's in here and it's all important. That's really awesome about like physical encyclopedias.
Yeah. Did you end up like tinkering on any projects because you were reading this stuff?
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. Mostly in the like either explosives, like the chemical stuff. My cousin.
So were you like one of the PayPal guys that built pipe bombs in high school or whatever?
a lot earlier than high school. But by the time I was in high school, I was much more into like the computers and electronics. But like earlier in that, like middle school and earlier, building all sorts of explosives and chemical experiments and that kind of stuff. Especially with my cousin, he's much more of like the chemistry thinker. We built a blast shield chamber out at my grandfather's farm. So he had like 100 acres out in Illinois, and we built like a wooden like blast shield.
And how old are you at this point?
I think we started doing that kind of stuff when we were like 8 or 9, something like that. So that was super fun.
So there were signs.
many explosions. You know, we lit our hands on fire multiple times and, you know, try to get them off, that kind of stuff. Just trying to understand things. I remember at one point I tried to, you know, like those yuccas, like the yucca plants.
Yeah,
they have like a fruit on top. I actually can't remember. I think they're acidic inside. And so we came up with this like base solution that you could like, you take a needle and you like inject it with a base solution. It would grow pressure inside the yucca pod, and then it would pop.
Yeah.
And we would like do that and throw it at each other. So that was, yeah, that was one of our fun things to do. And then later I got into sort of like electronics and taking things apart. I was obsessed. Like I never ever got a Christmas gift that I did not immediately completely disassemble.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's like way easier to disassemble things than put them back together. So I never had functional Christmas gifts. Like if you buy me a remote control car, I would drive it like once and then take it apart and it would be
broken and you couldn't put it back together.
Yeah, it would not play with my Christmas gifts in that way. But I had, like racks of like junk drawers. My mom would call them, like, why are you keeping all these junk drawers? And it was basically just disassembled pieces of technology. I just called it all like technology. I didn't have any sort of like subcategory below that. But old pieces of calculators, lived in sort of a you know, poor neighborhood, basically wherever we lived. And there was no shortage of just like garbage, like around. You could just walk around our street and just find garbage, and we would pick through it and find anything that appeared to have like a circuit board on it. And then we would just stare at it for hours. Me and my friend Nicholas on our street, we would just stare at these things like for hours and hours, try to figure it out, go look at the encyclopedias. That took me the longest time to like actually understand. The chemical stuff like made sense, but without any like anybody who really understood electronics, that was this like crazy mystery to me all growing up. I was totally obsessed for a long time until I was about like, I think like 13, when I finally got access to the internet and Wikipedia, and I could actually like go all the way down to like the bit level. But it felt like magic for like the longest time of like, how is this working? It felt like it did not belong in the physical world. It didn't like map to any other concept around me. Like how is this thing thinking? How is it, you know, where are these properties coming from? And it was like a energetic source of frustration to me for years that I did not understand how that worked.
Yeah. And then, so you said you like find these circuit boards or whatever, stuff like that. Eventually at like, I don't know if it was as early as 13, but at like 14, 15, you start programming, I believe.
Yeah. I think it was like 11 or 12. I started programming. I found a book on C# on my dad's shelf. My dad's not a software engineer, but he has always been like really interested in computers and software. And at some point picked up a C# book. So I read that. I did not get super far with C#, mostly because I had no idea where to begin with the tooling. I'd never heard of like Visual Studio before, or like had any idea how to download that or get it. But I had a friend, one of my dad's friends who was a programmer, told me about this like basically kid programming language. It was called Frogram. So if any of the authors of Frogram see this, you can DM me. I'll say thank you. But it was basically like a Visual Basic variant, and it was a full integrated IDE. So it shipped with like everything you would possibly need to build, everything from like Hello World to pretty good advanced like graphics games, like 2D graphics games. And it shipped with like hundreds of examples where all of the code to run the program is right there, and you could run it, and then you could actually read through the entire code base and figure out how it's working. And that was incredible. That like started to really make everything click for me. This was around like 12 or 13, but I think when people are learning a new thing, you have to be able to like, you have to be able to see a full working example of something and trace the causal relationships all the way down to like ground level and see it integrate all the way from like 0 to 100 and back again, and be able to like work with it and play with it.
Especially like have a 3D model in your mind and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. If there's any like area of ambiguity, it can wreck the whole process. And so sometimes when people are like learning how to do new things or like part of a curriculum, a lot gets like skipped over and you're told like, well, you know, like don't worry about this part, that sort of thing. And that can like give people a picture of reality that is unnecessarily confusing. Like you'll get this feeling of like, oh, well, I can't really understand how that works.
Yeah.
That's a little too advanced for me. But if you instead put someone in a playground where they can see the thing working, and then they can look all the way down to the very base layer and all the way back up again, it gives you this like level of confidence across the whole operation. Yeah. That was fantastic. Highly recommend things of that nature if you're trying to, like if you have a, you know, 12-year-old, 13-year-old trying to learn something. That was about like 12 or 13 that I started working on that.
Yeah. What would be your process for learning a new subject or discipline?
That's a good question. So if it's it's always like the answer is always practice. You always, and I don't mean like repetition necessarily, I mean doing it.
Yeah.
Reading is always very limited utility. You have to see the effect of what you do, and you have to quickly be exposed to the effect of your actions. Yep. So find somewhere that allows you to build the simplest possible thing where your own mind is responsible for the, you know, the base conditions and the outcome. And that might be extremely small and simple the first time, but find the smallest possible place you can do that, mm-hmm. and then continue with larger and larger complexity and outcome is how I'd tackle that, yeah.
Okay. I think at like 14 or 15, you started like programming for other people or like
yeah.
doing that. So what's the story yeah. behind that?
So I posed as a 22-year-old. I've always like looked a little bit older than I am. And so I had a photo that like I thought I looked older in. I posted it on, it was called Elance at the time. I think it's called Upwork now, but posed as like a 21, 22-year-old, listed like some of the things that I'd built, on Frogram and like had screenshots of it and that kind of stuff. And yeah, I started making some money here and there. It was small scale stuff, you know, go build this like integration for a website, go build this like data utility script, et cetera, you know, $500 for like a couple weeks of work sort of thing. And that was like catnip to me. I had no idea that you could actually
make money from doing this.
I had no clue. Yeah, I was like, this is really fun. It's fun to make these games. And when I realized like someone would actually pay me to like do that, that was like mind blowing. It was crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. How did your parents react?
My mom was a little bit confused what I was doing. My dad saw it from day one. Honestly, I have to give him so much credit. I remember like specific moments where my mom would like, and yeah, I love my mom. Sorry, mom. Like she would want me to stop being on the computer. And, my dad was like, no. Like let him keep going. He's going to make more money than me in like 5 years. This is when I was like 13 or something like that. So he was totally a believer in what I was doing. But I don't know that they were super happy with like how little I was spending on actual schoolwork, but they were at least happy that I was, you know, learning about the stuff for sure.
Yeah. So at 16, you decided to drop out of high school and you started an auto body shop.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that experience and what was your thinking going into that?
Yeah. From dropping out or from the auto body shop? Two different sets of lessons there, but
let's start with the dropping out.
Yeah. So I decided to drop out because, first of all, I went to an awesome charter school. So there's a charter school in Colorado Springs called Thomas McLaren School. It's a, you know, it's a state funded charter school, but this like really awesome group of teachers who were just incredibly passionate and like that's probably the most important thing you could possibly get in schooling is like teachers who really, really care about their subject. In fact, it felt like sometimes they cared more about their subject than about the students, which sounds a little counterintuitive, but it's actually really important,
yeah.
especially for guys. There's something about like teaching guys that they want to see a teacher who is like really obsessed with what he is teaching them. And like almost to the extent that like the student are like hardly even there. That could be taken too far, but there's an extent to which like you want to follow somebody who's like, wow, he's totally into that thing.
The excitement is contagious.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Yeah. So after spending a few years there, like I felt like I'd already gotten like a pretty good education, and so I didn't feel like I was dropping out because I thought learning was useless, but it was more that, you know, that I had already learned a set of really fun things, and I was already making money. So, you know, as a 16-year-old, I got a job offer to go and do software, and the calculus was like I could spend more time in school, I could maybe go to college. But most of my friends are like trying to go to college in order to get, you know, a job that pays money.
You're already doing it.
And I have a job that pays money. So, yeah. So I dropped out and yeah, my parents were like, again, not super enthused about that, but like, you know, from years before that, they had basically told me like, you know, you're 14 now, like you're going to do what you're going to do. So, you know, go and do it.
Oh my gosh. Okay. And then the auto body shop, how does that happen?
Yeah. So the auto body shop was fun. I started that when I was 17. So about a year after I dropped out, and I started it because I wanted money, frankly. I was like, well, I'm making a bit of salary, but what I really want to do is I want to like revolutionize energy, and I want to have this like mass manufacturing thing where I like make a billion nuclear reactors and we get on the Kardashev scale and energy's free. So how do you do that? Well, you need money to do that, right? You know, Elon put $100 million into SpaceX from like Zip2 and PayPal. So like, that's how you do things. Okay, how do I go get a bunch of money? And it's like, well, the most obvious thing to do is like, look at the market and see what do people need. And so start a company, you can get some money. That was my logic. So there was this, I was coding like 80 hours a week at the time. I was coding 80 hours a week for a couple different contractors, some DOD, like
what
embedded.
What were you earning per week at that time?
Let's see. I don't know about per week. I was earning about 150 or 200K, like salary per year type thing. So that was when I was 17. It felt like hot stuff for sure. I bought myself a little orange convertible. But I was working like insane hours, living on my friend's mattress. I literally didn't even have sheets. I had like a pillow with no pillowcase, no sheets, and then like a sleeping bag on top of a mattress. And I would basically just wake up. It was awesome, actually. It was so fun. Wake up, start coding. It was like this embedded Linux platform. I would go downstairs, sit on the couch, code. My friends would hop on like Far Cry. So like they would start playing Far Cry. I would be coding, watching them play Far Cry. And then, you know, one of them would like go to class or something like that, because I was living with college students. And then when they'd go to class, I would get on the console and play Far Cry for a little bit. And then one of them would like come home from, you know, a job or whatever. So I'd hop on the laptop. I'd basically just do that till like 11 p.m. and go back to sleep. So that was my life. And after a little bit, I was like, man, I need to be working with my hands. Like, software's fun. I'm learning a lot. I need to work with my hands. So I found this guy in my church, actually, who I saw that he was advertising that he would work on people's cars. Mm-hmm. So I showed up to his house, and I was like, hey, I heard you work on cars. He was working on some cars in his driveway. And I said, I would love to, like, just pull some wrenches with you. Like, I just want to come out here on a Saturday.
Learn it.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm working like 80 hours a week on a computer. I need to do something physical. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, can I just, you know, turn some wrenches? So for a couple Saturdays, I came out there with him and, yeah, just wrenched on cars. Always loved cars. And after like 2 or 3 weeks, I noticed just his entire cul-de-sac was full of cars. And it was like filling up, and his neighbors were mad at him. And I was like, dude, like, you got to get yourself a shop. Like, you have so much demand. I had tried to get my car fixed somewhere else, and there was like 4 or 5 week lead times at every auto shop. And he was like, yeah, man, that would be awesome. I'd love my own shop. And so I was like, well, let's start a shop. And then there's this other guy who lived in the same apartment complex as me. And I had heard that he also did not really spend much time studying in high school, and instead had worked his way up as a teenager to regional manager of a McDonald's.
Oh, really?
And in Washington, and now he lived in this apartment complex in Idaho. That was the only thing I'd heard about him. And I met him in the parking lot one time admiring my orange convertible. And so we talked about the car for a little bit, and I was like, hey, you're that guy that, like, you know, ran a McDonald's, right? And like, didn't really do much school. He just kind of did this thing. And so we exchanged phone numbers, and then we went to a John Bellion concert together. So there's this 5-hour drive to Seattle. We went to this John Bellion concert, 5-hour drive there, 5-hour drive back, talked a lot. So I'd met him twice, once in the parking lot, once at this John Bellion concert. And it was on Thanksgiving break. He had gone back home to his family, and I'd had this conversation with Jonathan. So I called him. This is our third conversation. I called him over Thanksgiving break, and I said, hey, I think we should start an auto shop together. And he said, okay, let's do it. And so we both basically put our money together, rented a shop, bought, you know, lifts and equipment and, you know, compressors and office equipment and, you know, outfitted a shop,
yeah.
Started a company. And, you know, Kip, this is the other guy, had also done some marketing, just freelance marketing stuff. And so I was like, well, you know, he could probably make the logo and those sorts of things. So, yeah, he was 18, I was 17 at the time, and, started it up. So yeah, we both just kind of put in the money that we had earned from working and not studying and launched it. So,
yeah. So after that, my understanding is between like the age of how long did that go on?
So that company's still running.
It's going today.
Yeah, it's doing great. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm on the board. And yeah, it's a
profitable business.
Yeah. It's really fun. Okay. Yeah. It's super
That's wild.
Fun.
So at like 19, I know that you said that you went through basically like 6 or 7 ideas before you settled on Valor. What were the other ideas that you were thinking about?
Well, I went through 6 or 7 iterations of Valor before landing on this concept. We did have some other things that we thought might be a little bit easier to tackle.
What were those?
So one of those was we wanted to... this is another idea I'd bounced around with my buddies. We all love aircraft. We love flying. Mm-hmm. And we had all been just really frustrated with commercial aviation. Like, this system is, like, totally broken. And so we kind of, like, analyzed, like, what's wrong with aviation and why do commercial airlines suck so bad? And basically the answer we came to was, like, okay, there's this base set of infrastructure, which is, like, airports. And airports are expensive and they're hard and they're complicated. One of those reasons is that runways have to be a certain length. Mm. And we basically like realized like if you could make like runways a lot shorter, you could probably have like more distributed airports, which mm-hmm. would hopefully just like open up the total number of routes. And we also decided that like aircraft don't fly enough. So there's too much time when aircraft are on the ground, mm-hmm. which increases the cost too much. So we basically came up with this design for like a 737 with like a detachable body. So it would have like a detachable cabin. This is, you know, crazy 17-year-old ideas, but like we wanted to have this like launcher system that you basically like have an automated like pickup where you all get into the cabin and then it like launches you into the air and then it just mates with like a flying wing that was like already flying and specifically is like aerodynamically tuned for cruise, because aircraft always have this like dual mission thing where they're like both they're both supposed to cruise, like their aerodynamic profile has to be able to cruise efficiently, but then has to be able to land as well.
Yeah.
And like landing and cruising are like really, really different flight states that are from an engineering perspective opposed to each other. And so we wanted to fix that by basically having these like hyper efficient flying wings that were autonomous that didn't ever have to land, or at least landed only at these like really large airports. Mm-hmm. And then you have separate launch systems where you just like go to a bus station basically, and you just all get into this cabin, and then, you know, the cabin launches inefficiently, right? Because it's like some sort of lift system that's less efficient, but then it goes and it mates to this, you know, more efficient long range wing.
In theory, save a bunch of money on the airports.
Yeah, so it allows you to have like a lot of small launch places, mm-hmm. and that should hopefully like break up sort of like the monopoly system of like large airports was our idea. And it would also mean that like these flying wings should be like most of the CapEx, mm-hmm. and they always fly. So like they have high utilization because a lot of times airplanes are just sitting on the ground. Mm-hmm. And so those are the major two concepts. That one was really fun because we had a friend who had a lake house up on Lake Coeur d'Alene. And this is just like Kip using his skill set. We had like 4 buddies that went up there for like 2 weeks. So he convinced this guy to let us use his lake house for free. And we went up there with just like huge sheets of like engineering paper. And we basically just like designed this system for modular air transportation with like how the wing would work and what the engineering parameters would be and the aerodynamics and that kind of stuff. And then, you know, how to engineer the, like the lifting stations. So that was super fun. After like a couple weeks of working on that, we found that Airbus had already thought through all this and patented it. So, silly teenagers, we didn't realize that patents don't really matter that much, but we decided that
was just a massive roadblock in your mind. So you're like, can't be done. It's not
someone's
impossible.
Thought of it. Yeah. Boeing's like Airbus has patented it, not happening. So we abandoned that, but yeah.
what was the next thing that you guys, or you thought about?
Yeah. So, I mean, Valor is really where I've spent a ton of my time thinking, mm-hmm. and iterating through. We've had other ridiculous ideas. We've thought of like a bunch of different designs for like personal aircraft that, you know, are supposed to go extremely fast and all these things. Those have been really fun. Oh, also, maybe this is fun to talk about. One of my concepts that I pursued for a while was called Big Slow Plane.
Big Slow Plane.
Big Slow Plane. So I decided, again, just trying to tackle the question of, like, why does it cost so much to fly? Like, flying costs way too much. It's getting more expensive, not less expensive. We should be able to, like, get from here to there for, like, you know, $100, not, like, $500. And trying to think through like why that is and why this industry is stagnating. So just thinking about it from like the engineering side, for a while we tried to go to the direction of like supersonics. Like we had the Concorde for a while, and that was super fun. And then hypersonics have, you know, lots of people are thinking about that right now. But I started back from like the aerodynamic side and thinking about, well, what if you just wanted like the cheapest version of flying? Like you can get on this with 1,000 other people and it's $100 and it's super cheap. Well, going slower is actually better than going faster if you're optimizing that way, not just in fuel costs, but also like in the strength of engineering and like the types of materials you have to use and all these things. You know, aerodynamic drag is a nonlinear increase with speed and all these things. And it's not just how much drag is on it, but it's also the forces at play, which means how you have to mount the panels and how the structural engineering has to be done, all those sorts of things. So slower is better in general. And there's actually like a specific shape that is like optimal for laminar flow. It kind of looks like an egg. So basically what I figured out is, now here's the interesting thing. It doesn't scale with size either. So you can't make just like a giant egg. That's like laminar flow basically does not scale the bigger you make that egg.
Interesting.
So there's a perfect size of egg, which is like you get laminar flow across the entire airfoil. And you want everything else behind the end of laminar flow. So what it looks like is you have like a wing in the back and an engine in the back and then an egg in the front. So that's generally what it
should. Does that almost look like a blimp?
Yeah, it kind of looks like a blimp with like engines and stuff on the back.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's supposed to go like 170, 180 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. You can stay in laminar flow that fast. But what I realized was you can actually get the like experience of flying to be way better, even though it's going to take longer. So these things are going to like fly a lot slower. They're going to fly like half the speed of an airliner. Mm-hmm. But I figured like people would probably rather have like a bedroom all to themselves that costs $100. You could sit in there, you can work, you could take a nap. And it's really cheap rather than, you know, sitting in a cramped space for less time. That was, you know, my thought. But the other part is you need things to be really big, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have to get that scale in there.
Yep.
And you have to get the scale efficiencies. So the model I came up with was basically like a bunch of these like linked, like blimp looking things with one common wing in the background. Because again, unfortunately, like that egg shape does not scale with size. You can't just make a giant egg. Laminar flow will break at the same, like at a further point, the bigger it is.
Yeah.
Basically you want these like long, you want a long horizontal wing and then a bunch of these like pods that don't ever break laminar flow. And so you could get, you could get the structural side of that to be way cheaper because, again, you're working with like way fewer aerodynamic forces, and that sort of like, you know, elliptical shape is just structurally better anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I played with that for about a year.
And then I also think I was talking with Augustus yesterday, and he said that you're thinking about starting with a like SaaS or something.
Yeah.
And you were like going to try and cut your teeth on a SaaS company and build that and then pursue this other, you know,
that's
Valor.
Right. That's right. So
why did you decide not to do that? Or you decided to just go
Well,
for
I
it?
Did it once. Okay. So after the auto shop, I did do a SaaS company. Hmm. And yeah, again, the thought was like, I wanted to get to $50 million. I wanted to get to net worth $50 million. And I figured that must be the golden number at which I can actually go and start my hard tech company that I want to start.
Yeah.
I've heard this sentiment echoed a million times from other people who are either have finally gotten into hard tech or have not yet gotten into hard tech. It's so common at this point. Like, I need to do my SaaS and then I can do my hard tech thing. So I actually did it. That company failed, but it started in 2019. It was a B2B SaaS with an IoT play. So basically it was four auto shops. We wanted to make the auto industry proactive rather than reactive. So the idea is your auto shop, it should not be somewhere that you go to the auto shop because you have a problem. It should be something where you're paying a subscription and the auto shop is just maintaining your car.
Oh,
And they're thinking about the long-term life of your car. And because of that, like, it's sort of like an insurance model where they should be able to make decisions that make your car work better in like 2 years.
Yep.
And they save the money on that. And on your side, you know, you just never think about maintenance, right? So in order for that to happen, they have to have a lot of data. So they have to be able to know exactly what's going on with your car. So we had this little module, we called it a hub link. The business was called Hood Hub. And we had the hub link, which was this IoT device, plugs into your car, reads all your engine data. And And then the hub link would go communicate with our servers, and the auto shop has a dashboard where they can see all of the car's data.
And it was actually, they can like call you in when there's something wrong.
Yeah, exactly. It was actually super sick. Like, you could actually see, I have videos of like live readouts of people's engine data while they're driving along. And Jonathan, who's the manager of the auto shop we started, co-owner, on the phone with a customer being like, yep, I'm looking at it right now. You're good. You know, don't worry about that check engine light. You're going to be fine, right? So we could have like live readouts of check engine lights and that sort of thing. But really same thinking, which is like, okay, doing like the hard tech thing is going to be really hard. And not just really hard, but I was mostly just thinking about funding. Did not grow up in Silicon Valley, have never grown up around capital, like grew up mostly on food stamps. And the idea of like raising money was just completely foreign to me. Like, we started our first company, you know, just with like cash from our bank accounts, and had no idea that there's even a thing where like people give you money for a venture. That just was a category that did not exist. And so the idea of like going and raising $100 million for a nuclear company just did not exist as a category.
It seemed impossible or not even something that you'd think about.
It just would never have even occurred to me that that's a thing. And so, my second company, it was the same concept, like get to that 50 million mark, that will give me what I need to go and do the real thing.
Yeah. So I know that the community here is absolutely incredible. And you also didn't initially live in El Segundo. Where did you live initially?
So Northern Idaho is where I started those two companies.
Okay.
I've moved all over the U.S., moved a ton of times. But Northern Idaho is where I started those two. I moved there when I was 17. Yeah.
And what brought you to El Segundo?
So I looked at every single major metro in the U.S. Mm-hmm. When starting Valor. So last summer when I... you know, started the company, I knew I was not going to be able to build a $1 trillion company from North Idaho. Just didn't have the infrastructure and the resources. And so once I knew I was going to leave, which, you know, was big because I love living in North Idaho. I still love it. It's just my favorite place in the world. I love the people and everything that's there. But once I knew, okay, I'm not going to be here, I had a totally open book and I knew I was going to move somewhere where I knew nobody. And so I had a clean slate. And I looked at every major metro in the U.S., and I decided on L.A. and then El Segundo specifically because mostly talent. There's just such an incredible wealth of really, really talented engineers here across a lot of disciplines that matter for Valor and what we want to do. Mm-hmm. Being able to actually make metal do what you need it to do under intense conditions is kind of the key thing that we need to be able to do well. And this... you know, not just like LA, but like this neighborhood in LA has been doing that basically since the 1940s on some really, really incredible stuff.
Like 80 years.
Yeah. 80-year history of, you know, just generations of knowledge being passed down from one kid to another on how to do some of the hardest engineering.
Yeah, so very similar to like Elon and starting SpaceX and deciding to headquarter in LA.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, actually... if you're looking at starting a hard tech company right now, like I have to recommend El Segundo because, I mean, I went through this process. I went through the whole selection. And again, with a totally clean slate, I had no bias. I was actually biased against LA. I really hoped it wasn't going to be in LA. Yeah.
Why?
Just because, you know, the politics of California are getting so difficult to operate as, you know, in business. It's getting really hard in the taxes and the regulations and like nuclear fission. Is like most forms of nuclear fission are actually illegal in California.
Really?
Yeah. So it's not like the best place on the like technical business side of the house where you're thinking about how to run business with taxes and regulations and all these things. So I was hoping that it was going to be Texas or Florida or something like that. But I talked to founders in Texas and Florida and everywhere. And the fact is like the best engineers in the world live in Southern California. And especially if you're talking about doing things in the real world, doing things with atoms, making metal do what you need it to do. Like it's LA and it's El Segundo.
Yeah. What impact have the other like really good founders here had on you?
What impact have they had on me? I mean, look, it's a brotherhood.
Yeah.
It's a brotherhood. What impact do your brothers have on you? I don't know.
I don't know. Everything.
I
kind of feel like you guys are going to be able to go a lot further because you have each other than
undeniably.
You would otherwise.
Undeniably. Yeah. I mean, it's night and day. We compete with each other. We have fierce competition. One thing that's, I think, probably underrated is the extent to which we are actually quite savage with each other. Like, you would be shocked to see, like, the group chat arguments that we have amongst each other on our companies and the methods that we're using to accomplish what we need to do.
Yep.
And even down to the core of, like, is your idea even good? Are you starting a real company? Like, should this company exist? Yeah. What are you doing? Yeah. Like, we will go hardcore. We will not hold back. But, you know, on the flip side, like, if you pass that fire test, you have just the most incredible community in the world.
Yeah. So what are the biggest, we talked yesterday and you basically said, if you put one power plant or 100 power plants, it's the same environmental study and it's like $200 million or whatever to get it done.
Yep.
What are the other, including that, what are the other physical or like fixed costs associated with building this kind of thing, a nuclear power project?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when people think about nuclear power, they're imagining that the reactors have to be cheaper, like the reactor cores. And that's not really true. Mm. It's not a bad thing. Like, it's great if you can make a cheaper nuclear reactor. But really, most of the cost is capital and plant. So cost of capital and cost of plant are the two major costs in nuclear power. And what that means is environmental surveys and siting and, you know, nuclear power is such a... there's so much construction, and it's unique construction and novel construction. I just realized, is that from Ball? That cup? That's cool. That's very cool. Making disposable aluminum cups and also space telescopes. Awesome company. Anyway.
Shout out to Ball.
Yeah, shout out to Ball. let's see, where was I?
The environmental impact, stuff like that.
Yeah, sorry, totally ADHD moment
No,
here.
Perfect.
So a lot of it is specific to your site. Mm-hmm. So much of your cost is specific to your site and the person who is, you know, the company, the organization that is authorizing the site and financing the site. And then there's parties that are bringing labor and there are parties that are bringing the cores. And all these things are coming together for a specific physical location. And if you're making, let's say you have a nuclear reactor company or you have a nuclear power company and you're making one reactor that's going to make a certain amount of power in Nevada and another one in New York, the people who build those two sites, like the actual people who do the welding and pour the concrete and the rebar and all these things, completely different people.
Interesting.
In fact, different unions, like different labor unions, are going to be governing those two different processes. And different, like, regulations about how the capital is raised and, like, how much capital needs to be had on hand. And all of these things make nuclear as an industry just really, really site-specific and site-bound.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is there are incredibly difficult scaling laws associated with scaling nuclear power. So, like, the world has committed to basically tripling our nuclear capacity in the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about what that means, it's a coordination problem of unbelievable magnitude. Because you have so much dissimilarity between, like, literally just the geological locations where you're building each site. So what you were getting to is what we talked about yesterday, which is you want to minimize how important the site is and mm-hmm. maximize the power.
Yeah.
So if you really want to do super cheap nuclear, what you have to do is you have to pick somewhere, you know, draw a circle and say, this is our nuclear site. And you're going to have to pay for all the things we talked about. You're going to have to pay for labor crews. You're going to have to pay for an environmental survey. You're going to have to pay for compliance. You're going to have to figure out the capital, right? All of these things are going to have to come together. But you want to do that only once or maybe twice. And then you want to just put tons of power on that site, mm-hmm. right? You want to put, like, hundreds of gigawatts of power onto that one circle.
And what, in just for, like, reference, what is a typical power plant, nuclear power plant? What does it typically produce?
So generally, like, 1 to 4 gigawatts is pretty standard.
So you're doing, like, two orders of magnitude.
Exactly.
Minimum.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, 1 to 4 is standard. The largest nuclear site in the world is an 8-gigawatt plant. There are two approximately 8-gigawatt plants, one in China and one in Japan. Mm-hmm. So that's, like, the biggest that we build nuclear today. But what you want to do is you want to build just tons of nuclear capacity on a singular site because, again, there's a set of costs that don't scale with the total amount of power there.
Yep.
And that's actually the majority of the costs don't scale with that. You're still going to be doing construction, but you should be doing construction with all one labor crew, right?
Okay.
And you're going to have to lay rebar, but you should be laying rebar the same way 100 times, right? Not with a different crew teaching them how to lay, you know, rebar once on this one site. So that's really, really important. And that's something that I realized, I mean, I guess 6 years ago when I dropped out of high school. And it's a problem that I've been trying to tackle in a bunch of different ways, just at the research level, for the last 5 or 6 years. And you know, like you alluded to before, I went through a bunch of different iterations to get there.
Yeah.
And I think we got to the right one.
So one thing that I'm really curious about is, I think typically when people are building power plants, they're building like a single power plant, right?
Yeah.
And you guys are trying to build hundreds, potentially.
That's right.
To me, there seems like there's an opportunity for you to iterate and improve and upgrade as you go.
Yeah.
My question is, do you have to get approved for every single change that you make to your power plant, or can you just like continuously make improvements?
That's a really good question. It's very dependent on where you build it. The answer to the question is yes, you will have to get approval for each iteration, you know, to a certain extent, but it depends a lot on where you are and what regulator you're working with. But again, I think that people over-index how hard it is to work with regulators a little bit. It's hard, and I wish the regulatory environment were different. It's changing in some good ways. But the most important thing is that you have the business model that justifies that work, because you are going to have to work with regulators. They're going to have to become convinced that what you're doing is right and that what you're doing is safe. That's unavoidable. But what you want to do is you want to be in a model where buying that cost down, one, is somewhat incremental cost, and you're not buying a whole new, you know, billion-dollar approval system every time. And then two, you want to make sure that once you go through that regulatory pain, you have access to a massive market. Like, you want a huge market on the other end of that.
Justify the expense and everything.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And it has to be accessible to you. That's the other problem. It's like, total addressable market is one thing, right? But it actually has to be accessible. You have to service it, right? So that's one, you know, thing that people miss a lot in nuclear is maybe, yeah, electricity generation, sure, it's a big market, but what's the nature of that market? Is it a market that you can serve from a single site? The answer is no. You actually cannot serve $1 trillion electricity generation market. You can't serve it from one place.
Yeah.
If you want to, you know, serve this $1 trillion electricity market, you're going to be doing a lot of construction in a lot of different places. We want to do a little bit of construction in one place and serve a massive, massive market.
Yeah. Can you explain why electricity is a bad product and why, like, natural gas and jet fuel are going to improve that?
Yeah. So electricity is a pretty poor product in a bunch of ways. One is that it's not transportable through space and time. And I'll say it's not dynamically transportable through space, and it's not really transportable through time. So by dynamically transportable, I mean if you have a nuclear, an electrical generation station, there are a few locations to which you can transmit that power, but you're hardwired in. So that means your total scope of where you can send that power is hardwired. It's preset. And that actually gives you really bad leverage. So like if you're a flower shop, you want to be able to sell your flowers to the best price, right? Whoever wants those flowers the most, you want to be able to sell to that guy. Yeah, yeah, at a given time. Right, so you want to be able to store it on the shelf because it's 12, you know, 12 midnight, and no one's buying flowers right now. And so you want to be able to put that flower on the shelf and come back to it at 9 a.m. the next day. Or maybe, you know, it's February 10th right now, and you want to keep that flower until February 13th. When people are going to be really, really desperate for those flowers, right? This is how business works. You want your product to be able to move in space and time to where it's most needed, and that's how you get actual, you know, value down that chain. Electricity is not like that at all. We don't really know how to store it through time, and what I mean by that is, like, batteries are too expensive. We don't have mass scale grid storage. If you're making electricity now, we basically don't have the solution for, like, storing that now and selling it later. That's getting slowly better, but it's just not there right now.
Yeah.
And then for space, again, like, you're constrained. You can only sell your flowers to five total people. But in New York City, there's, you know, 20 million. So you'd like to be able to sell it there, right?
Yeah. So something that I'm thinking about is, like, because you're constrained by space and time, how often are these plants that, even if you put out all the money in advance and you have the ability to generate like 7 gigawatts or whatever, how often are they actually utilized fully? And what utilization rate are they typically at?
Yeah, I think normal utilization levels right now are like 30 to 40% across the fleet, which is pretty bad.
That's terrible,
Yeah, someone correct me on that. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I think it's around 30 to 40%. But that's also a little bit of a deceptive number too, because it's not, that's like what their capacity should be. What's even larger than that is what the total electricity demand is. And that's still different because nuclear is not easily scalable up and down, right? So because of the way that, you know, neutronics works, basically, it's very difficult to get a nuclear power plant to vary its output level. And so,
can you explain that?
Basically, like, it's difficult to dynamically move the reaction rates in a nuclear reactor, depending on your construction. And it's also just like operationally obnoxious is like one way to say it, to like dynamically control nuclear power output. They are, you know, actually somewhat finicky machines that you don't want to change a whole ton. So if they're making power, you don't really want to be tuning them up and down a lot. It adds danger and operational complexity, and you know, some designs like you actually just can't because of decay heat and that sort of thing. So because of that, nuclear power is generally only ever going to be like 30 or 40% of demand, because again, with this like curve above that that varies a lot, you really want nuclear just to sit in that like stable base zone. And so that means, again, like it's just not utilized all that much. And then you have a bunch of other different power sources that fill out those peaks, right? So you, especially gas plants are really good at filling out peaks.
Yeah, and isn't doesn't China like use a whole bunch of like coal plants and stuff to do that as well?
Yeah, coal plants, you know, in the US we tend to use natural gas peakers. And yeah, but coal is also a very efficient way to do it for sure in terms of cost.
Okay, yeah. I'm also kind of curious about, like, if you start, let's say you put 100 power plants in the ocean, and then you also, I assume you want the like plant that turns the nuclear energy into hydrocarbons right next to the power plants, yes? Like in the ocean?
So what we're gonna, are you describing what Valor wants to do?
I think.
So Valor, we're actually gonna put everything on ground. So an earlier iteration, we can talk about some of the, like the steps that I went to get to where Valor is today. One of my earliest models was, sinking nuclear reactors out in the ocean for various reasons. But yeah, what we eventually want to do is we want to have massive nuclear power stations on the ground producing a ton of power and producing hydrocarbons co-located with the nuclear plants.
What kind of, I imagine if you suddenly have this like massive influx of new hydrocarbons, you'll probably need new infrastructure. What infrastructure around that?
Or so is that that's right actually or no? The awesome thing about hydrocarbons, like this is very much why I landed on hydrocarbons, is the infrastructure is already there. There is already the pipeline infrastructure and the burner plants and, you know, shipping and trucking and everything to consume hydrocarbons is A, already there, B, very scalable. Like the scaling of hydrocarbon usage as an industry is one of the most incredible industries on earth. Like if you want to study a highly, highly functional industry, you should go look at how the hydrocarbon infrastructure industry scales itself and operates. So what I mean is, when there is a source of hydrocarbons and when there is a need of hydrocarbons, the industry that pairs that source with that need is like one of the most crazy efficient things that you will ever see. Here's an example. My buddy runs this company. It's a water infrastructure company for oil wells. And they will get a call from an oil well that wants to drill. And when you're drilling oil, a lot of times in Canada, a lot of water gets used in the process. They use water to extrude things and to process things. They use a ton of water. And you know, this my buddy will get a call. And he'll say, you know, hey, we've got this pad that we're, you know, this pad that we've got over here, we're drilling on it. We need, you know, 50,000 cubes of water to go sit on this pad. And we need it in 8 days. So can you get us 50,000 cubes of water? And my buddy will say, All right, yeah, we can get that for you in 8 days. And they will call a bunch of landowners, right, all around this pad, and these people have ponds, and they have, you know, small lakes and access to a river and maybe a spring and a well.
Yeah.
And he will call each one of them and say, hey, can we buy this many cubes of water from you? And so then they'll go and they'll sign contracts with all these guys, and they'll actually go and set up pumps at each one of those wells, and then they'll lay temporary piping along roadways and under bridges and through drainage ditches, all leading to this one central pad. And they will build temporary on-site water storage tanks,
really?
Huge mini lakes, basically, like next to this pad, in 8 days, and then tear it all back up and just leave the water sitting there. And then they'll move on to the next site. And that's just the water side of this industry. The side of actually like moving hydrocarbons around, it's such a brilliant functional machine. It's truly an amazing thing. So the short answer, the very long way to answer your question is like, hydrocarbon infrastructure, moving hydrocarbons around, is like one of the most excellent and functional industries known to mankind.
So you're not gonna have any problems.
If you have hydrocarbons, like the hydrocarbon industry knows how to beat a path to you and knock on your door and say, please, can we purchase your hydrocarbons? So that's very much what we're counting on.
Okay, so I saw in one of your interviews, you said that I guess China spends around $2 billion to get 1 gigawatt online.
That's right.
And we spend roughly $15 billion.
Most recently at the Vogtle plant, that's correct, yeah.
$15 billion.
Yeah.
Why is there such a discrepancy?
Yeah, there is such a discrepancy for one massive overarching reason, and that is the incentive structure on how nuclear works in conjunction with the electricity industry. Mm. So basically, there's this problem with all of these kind of older industries where no one company has the excellent, fully integrated business model to deliver a product that people are paying for. Instead, mm-hmm. what you have is, you know, a utility company that maybe wants to add some capacity. And what they do is they go and try to integrate a project. So they try to go and get, you know, construction from over here, and they try to get a nuclear reactor from over here, or maybe they work with like one major contractor, and that contractor does the integration. So they try to get labor crews from over here, and they try to get reactor cores, and they try to get turbines, and it's basically a horizontal fractured industry that tries to assemble all these things together into a power plant. But the problem is there's no one player there that is purchasing a commodity product at the other end, which means those incentives stack up, and you basically have this like fractured cost plus system where this one guy is like, yeah, we'll lay that concrete for, you know, this continuous cost. It's not even fixed price. It's like, you will be paying us to do this for however long it takes. And it might take 7 years when it was supposed to take 2 years,
oh,
right?
God.
And you're still paying. And the other problem is like the way that those utilities are run are generally not very private, meaning you're not going to have a lot of private capital at stake. You'll probably have government money at stake. And, you know, that also means there's just less incentive for things to not
efficiency.
Go wrong. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the Vogtle plan is a $30 billion mess up, right? $15 billion over budget, which was already too expensive. And, you know, it's like, well, like taxpayers lost out on that, you mm-hmm. know, and like people who are paying their utility bills. But what are you going to do, right? Nobody is responsible for the cost of that entire machine all the way through.
Yeah.
The other problem, again, is just the difference of the momentum of the society that's doing those things. So like China has this top-down approach to it. They have a single design. They're like, go slap this down 100 different places. Mm. Where we're much more fractured. So they gain benefits in the centralization of that, right? Whereas we are extremely fractured. Now, you know, I think that there are a lot of good things about competition. There are a lot of good things about a lot of different players doing something, but it has to have the incentives all the way up to the top that actually, you know, makes that capitalist machine lead to good outcomes and lower prices. And that's just not how electricity generation is working today.
Hmm. So Elon has this idea that I really like called an idiot index.
Yes.
And I'm kind of curious, it's like the efficiency ratio of taking atoms and turning them into a specific object or whatever, right? A product. What is the idiot index?
Yeah. So specifically, the India index is like, what's the sale price of the thing versus what was the material cost?
Yeah.
So how much did the materials cost, and then what did you sell it for? And the like SpaceX pre-Elon, that India index was about like 75. Like a mature product should be like 1 to 2. Somewhere between 1 to 2. And yeah, space launch was like 75. By my best math, and we have a 40-page internal paper on this, it's about 150. So the India index is about 150 on nuclear. If you just add up what do the materials cost.
So it costs like $100 million for a power plant? Or am I missing something?
$100 million for like the normal
power
plant?
Well, if they're spending $15 billion and the India index is 150, that would be like 1/150th, right?
Yeah. So like what are the material costs in?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So it should cost like, let's say, $200 to $250 million per gigawatt for material cost. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, we're 150 times greater than that in some cases, between, 100 to 150 times better, worse. Massive, massive India index.
Massive opportunity.
Huge opportunity. And again, like that's just in the electrical market. So the opportunity when you multiply that by a market like hydrocarbons is astronomical.
Okay. You said in an interview, cheap hydrogen production is your biggest risk area right now. What is that? Or why?
Yeah, that's the biggest technological thing that we need to prove. It's not so much proving that it's possible. It's proving that we can do it at scale. It's really the core of the business is we make cheap hydrogen. And then the question is, okay, you have a bunch of cheap hydrogen. That's great. How do you sell it? And hydrogen today as a market is useful for a few things, but it's not a huge market. It's very, very difficult to transport. What you really want to do is transform that hydrogen into hydrocarbons. Because when you add CO2 to that mix, you have a bunch of hydrogen, you add CO2, it suddenly becomes, it's still got lots of potential energy. The thing that's great about hydrogen is it's got tons of potential energy, right, per mass. You can burn it and get electricity. You can, put it in a rocket and, get a launch. When you add CO2 in there, you get a hydrocarbon. And a hydrocarbon is a magical thing. Mm. It's pure magic. It's energy in a bucket. The fact that you can pour gasoline into a handheld container and carry it around is a massively underrated feature of modern society that we do not appreciate enough. It's very, very different from batteries. It's so different from batteries. If you want to hold energy and carry it around and it's in the form of a battery, you have to spend time to do that. You have to wait for it to charge. You have to sit there. And then at the end of the day, the amount of power you're holding is about 40 times less than the same container would hold for hydrocarbons.
Really?
So you're spending a ton of time and you're getting 40 times less energy per mass of that thing that you're holding. So hydrocarbons are incredible. And we should not, as a society, like leave them behind for the wrong reasons. The good reasons to like stop using hydrocarbons would be that we have found something that is more dense, both volumetrically and gravimetrically, and is safer and, all these other things. That's not what's going on with battery tech. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that like all electrical, electrification initiatives are bad. So like, for instance, I own a Tesla. Mm-hmm. Teslas are great. It makes sense to have, a lithium ion battery in a commuter car, for example, because it doesn't really matter that much how long it takes to charge that thing. It's going to sit at my house overnight anyway. The battery's heavy, but weight doesn't matter that much with cars. So there are definitely use cases where electrification makes sense. But there's also this huge spectrum of use cases where hydrocarbons are not only the best thing we have now, they're also like the emerging best thing we have into the future. Mm. So like Starship is an example of this. Turns out that like hydrocarbons are actually also the best thing you can put into a rocket to make a rocket take off, right? So the new Starship runs on Methalox. It's methane and liquid oxygen. Mm. So yeah, hydrocarbons are somewhat of a miracle that we should not underrate or leave behind.
Yeah. How do you take change the perception of both hydrocarbons and nuclear? Like, I imagine that you've thought about this.
Yes. First of all, we don't need to, which is one of the key things that I kind of set out when I started working on Valor, is that I decided I did not want to have to change public opinion about nuclear in order.
You wanted to go around that.
In order to be successful.
Yeah.
I wanted to genuinely reset the cost of energy in the world. And I realized that I needed to find a way to do that which did not hinge on me having to convince everybody that nuclear was the way. Which, if you're doing electrical power generation for the grid, you kind of need to convince everyone that it's okay. Or at least you need to convince a lot of people, because you have to, again, make all these different sites in different places. And each one of those has, you know, the NIMBYs of that area that don't want to see it happen. You've got to convince those, and the state regulators and the federal regulators. And there's all these people that you need to bring along with you. I wanted to find a model where we do not have to, there's a very limited number of people we have to convince that this is a good idea, and we can make our $1 trillion. Now, that said, I think once we do this, it will absolutely change the perception of nuclear as well. And the reason is we tend to fear the unknown. And nuclear is sort of unknown right now in that it is not a large enough feature of our society. It's not responsible for enough of the goodness in our society for us to really recognize its merit. And we just have very limited exposure to it. Part of that's like intentional on the utility industry. Like, utility companies don't really want you to think about the nuclear power station that much. Mm. They don't advertise the fact that it's sitting over there, because of the backlash they'll get about it. I think that Valor has the opportunity to, you know, make our awesome, sexy nuclear reactors that are making trillions of dollars of hydrocarbons and, you know, put them on TikTok and, you know, put them on Instagram Reels, and it'll be fun, right?
Yeah,
but we don't want to bank the company on it, but we absolutely want to, you know, change people's minds at the same time.
I was actually thinking of, like, you could take the great wonders of the world, like, you know, the Vegas, what is that, the Vegas Sphere, or even, like, Starship and say powered by nuclear or something, make it sexy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I absolutely would love to sell the Methalox to Starship. And you know, we get to do some really fun things. Like, once we've been able to make these reactors really successful on Earth, the reason that Methalox was chosen as the architecture for Starship, one of the reasons is that Methalox, methane in particular, is going to be synthesized on Mars.
Yep.
So we'll actually get our fuel on Mars from methane synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that those will be nuclear reactors from Valor that do that.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So I heard in one of your interviews that you were talking about someone named Jules Verne, and I was wondering how they influenced Earth. Yeah, how they influenced your thinking.
Yeah, Jules Verne, great Frenchman who also had a great dose of American spirit.
Mm-hmm.
From the Earth to the Moon is a fantastic book, a look into, well, really a look into, like, what the American spirit has always been perceived to be from the outside. And I think that's a healthy thing for us to see. I think that the United States is always... it's hard to tell from looking from the inside, like, what we represent to other people, to other nations. But what we represent is this, like, unbroken spirit of ambition. And America has always been very technological. Like, technology is so deeply part of who we are, and innovation. Like, this is the country that invented the car. This is the country that put man on the moon. This is so deep in our DNA. And, I love Jules Verne. He recognizes that. He also puts his French characters in there, which are always really fun. But sometimes, somebody from outside of the U.S. Actually has a clearer picture of, like, what we are, what we all are as, like, a collective, than we do from the inside sometimes.
Yeah. Are there any other people that really, like, inspired you?
Yeah. Speaking of, like, sci-fi, so Jules Verne is, like, early sci-fi. Robert Heinlein. Massive inspiration. Starship Troopers, one of the best books ever written. Incredible book. Again, like, it's just this, like, global Empire Americana feeling is awesome. I think that's absolutely where we're going, and I'm very excited. What is it? The 1,000-year American Empire on 1,000 planets.
With, like, a trillion humans or something?
A trillion humans on 1,000 worlds. It was my tweet the other day. And but Heinlein also, he's a true student of the human spirit as well. He's not just a sci-fi author, like, deep understanding of, like, politics and philosophy, and a beautiful writer.
Yeah. How much cheaper can you make, or how much cheaper can you produce the power plants by mass manufacturing them? If there's an idiot index that's like 150?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll start with like where we need to get in order to be profitable. Mm-hmm. So like starting at idiot index of 150, what do we have to bring that down to making jet fuel, making hydrocarbons in order for us to be able to sell those hydrocarbons on the market for less than the oil and gas industry sells them? And that multiple is, let me do the math in my head, about, we need to get it down to about 70. Mm. So if we can get the idiot index of nuclear down to about 70, we have a profitable company.
Which sounds very doable.
I think it's abundantly doable. It's honestly just doable by fixing the incentive structures. Like if we didn't innovate on technology at all, and all we did was just like take the existing technologies and just did it as a single vertically integrated company, mm-hmm. you would easily get it under the 70 mark. Maybe not even vertically integrating, just like doing it in a not stupid way, like with one company that's directing it for a very large product. Would probably get us under 70. But there's like three different things that we're doing at once. Like one, it's that like centralized direction of a single company mm-hmm. that's gonna be so important. And then there's vertical integration, which means like we are going to own the process of developing all of those technologies and the labor of installing them. The final one is actual technological innovation. The stack of those three things, I think we get the idiot index much closer to like 10 or 20.
Oh, really?
And that's only the beginning. Like yeah. beyond that, actually, the math changes and your baseline for what an idiot index of one is changes because your material costs should change with innovation. So mm-hmm. like the base of the idiot index is like, what's your material input? And once you actually start innovating, which the industry really just doesn't do, you know, because of these incentive problems, we get innovation in labs, but very little actually gets built.
Yeah, you said something about like the utilities are mostly controlled. I mean, they're not technically controlled by the government, but they straddle the amount that you can earn. Yeah. And
anything like that's subsidized by the government is risk averse and not incentivized to change and innovate mm-hmm. and all these things. And so, yeah, there are incredible designs for nuclear reactors that change that math to an order of like 50x. That have been prototyped and even built in some countries
wow.
in labs, and you know those are on my mind. They're on the roadmap, on the horizon. But you know, first we're just going to get down to like, okay, we're actually building nuclear reactors. We're actually selling hundreds of billions of dollars of jet fuel, and then we get to do the really really fun work of like driving the base of that cost down
lower
really really low with innovation. Yeah.
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 So this is a massive undertaking. It's going to probably take 10 or 15 years until you're like actually, I imagine it's like scaling to those hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, we would like to be, so the kind of mile marker there is like, at what point is your R&D budget mostly coming from cash reinvested by selling your product? And to be there, I want to be there in like 8 years.
8 years.
Yeah, so to the point where it's like our R&D budget's coming off of the cash flow,
mm-hmm.
that's like that inflection point. I put that at like 8 or 9 years.
Yeah. Okay. What kind of people, I saw on a whiteboard up there, everything around here is like high agency and urgency.
Yeah.
Why are those traits so important in like early employees especially?
Yeah, because time is absolutely everything. Close ranks with reality is probably like the prime directive of Valor Atomics. We must repeatedly close ranks with reality. You have to become exposed to the reality of what you are building as soon as you possibly can.
Yep.
And it actually takes so much internal energy to do that. It's not something that will happen to you if you sit there. Like
yep.
You can sit at a desk for years. You can sit in the lab for years and have very limited, slow trickle exposure to reality. But exposure to reality is the way that you actually learn and move forward. And you actually have to like force that on yourself. You have to pull, you know, that reality onto you and go seek it out and find it. And it takes coming in every single day and choosing to tackle reality.
To take action.
Yeah, because yeah. The default is that you will be exposed to reality over the course of your life, but it will be slow, it'll be a trickle. Sometimes it'll be all at once. But if you want to move very fast and learn very fast, you have to do constant energetic work to learn what reality is like. And that means doing aggressively. It means acting aggressively, constantly, every single day. It's not at all a natural, continuous thing. It's something that is default not going to happen unless you like continuously infuse it.
Have you thought about, so Elon sets very aggressive schedules, but he also, if you look at his track record, gets more done than pretty much anyone else or his companies do. Have you thought about that and like how, you know, how to set schedules that are doable, that you can hit them, but they're also extremely aggressive and it requires you to kind of like do things that in a typical day, you're not, you know?
I would say if your deadline... If your deadline does not seem literally impossible,
it's
then
too much.
It's way too conservative. If your deadline seems reasonable, here's a good acid test. Go to an industry expert. So if you're doing a hard tech startup, go to an industry expert and tell him your timeline. If he doesn't like gawk at you and like hang up the phone, then your timeline is not aggressive enough. Because that is how the only way that incredible technology moves forward.
Yeah.
So like, you know, you can go to patrickcollison.com/fast. This is a great website. You know, I'm sure a lot of hard tech people go to, but like the P80 shooting star at Skunk Works, Kelly Johnson and his team created that. And from the commission that they received to build the P80 to the first 500 mile an hour test flight was 143 days. If you told anybody that you're going to build a kit plane in 143 days, they're going to gawk at you. And if you're talking about building the first fighter jet in 143 days, you get laughed out of any, you know, aeronautical engineering room.
Yep.
But that is how startups must execute. They have to. Again, the default here is inaction. The default is going slower, waiting for suppliers. Don't wait for suppliers.
Oh yeah, are you, so I know that Boeing once like prided themselves, they like put out publicly that they prided themselves on, I think, being supplied by 140,000, like some crazy number of suppliers. And SpaceX, of course, is trying to vertically integrate everything, you know? How do you think about that?
So the trade-offs that happened here are, the reason that people went toward horizontal integration is, in theory, you should be able to get leverage, financial leverage on certain parts of your business. Let's say you have a process and it works a certain way, and the people who are running that process, let's say you've got Acme Incorporated and they're making widgets, and you've got the employees of Acme Incorporated, and it's been designed, the process has been designed, the machines and the tools are all designed, and it's there, it's a process, it's making stuff, all right? It's almost guaranteed that somewhere in the world that process can be run more efficiently, right? Because there's somewhere in the world that has a better confluence of tools and labor, where if you put that in this room, it's going to be a lot cheaper than in your R&D center here in California. Basically guaranteed that that's the case, right? And so in the 70s, or in the, really the 80s, a lot of companies started realizing this, and they said, hey, wait a minute, like we could probably get not just better cash flow, but better competition on price across the board if we take a bunch of these parts and we go distribute them out. And our, you know, especially if we, you know, even if we separate them into different companies, they'll take a profit, and that takes a little bit. But even like their base and their profit is going to be less than what it costs us to do it here, because this is just not where you have cheap labor and cheap tooling and all these things. So that was the logic. And you had this massive, you know, horizontalization of everything. And that works for a very limited time. But what it misses is innovation. That is a model of the world that does not include change. And technology changes. It should change at a rapid, rapid pace. It should be so different every year. So what that misses is that, yes, you could, you know, export the operation, you know, the operation of that thing and save a little bit of money. The problem is that operation should change next year, right? You should not save 20% on that operation by moving it across the world. You should save 40% on that operation by changing how it works, like deleting part of it, right?
Yeah.
And you can't change something that's across the world. You have to have your engineers looking at how that thing works. And you have that one 20-year-old kid that's like, that looks dumb. Why are we doing it that way?
Yeah, Elon's literally got a rule that make things less dumb, make requirements less dumb or something that.
Yeah. Well, it takes engineers looking at the machine because you will sit there and look at the machine. We're right next to the El Segundo refinery right here. And that was very intentional on my part. I want myself and my employees to look out at the refinery and see how the big boys do hydrocarbon production, right? But I love to sit there and look at it, because if you look at it, you can see the logic of how everything's put together. And going driving across this refinery every single day and looking at the logic of how all of these parts are composed and how the processes are composed and how fluids are moved from one area to the other and how the cooling systems works and how the scaffolding is built all around it, you start to think about that process, and it's very internal and intuitive and not based on numbers.
Yeah.
And eventually you're like, wait a minute, you should probably delete that. And if you are not actually being exposed to that every single day, and your smartest engineers and your young engineers who have never seen the system before are not looking at that every single day, you are not going to iterate that thing.
Yeah.
And then the next step is like, wait a minute, hold on. Like, Johnny, come over here. Let's prototype this, right? Can we delete that? Can we do that by next Tuesday? Hold on. Look at this. We did this thing. It works, and we deleted that part. Can we go change that process? And that's how industries move forward. And you cannot do that with horizontal structures. For us, for Valor, we want to be as integrated as we can possibly be, maximally integrated. And there, the downside of that is, like, yes, some things will cost more. We're going to have to buy down a lot of tooling, all that kind of stuff. But the speed is worth it. The pace is worth it. The innovation is worth it. Let's see. I was going to say one other thing about that. I'll remember in a second.
When you end up deciding to, when you first like build the factory that's going to produce all of these power plants, are you going to put the R&D facility like right next to the factory or inside the factory so that the engineers can kind of interact with what's actually happening?
Yeah, we want to be as co-located as we possibly can. Uh-huh. And again, as integrated as we possibly can. So like, even to the extent of like laying our own concrete. And like, that's not something that a hard tech company normally does, is like think about laying concrete. But it matters, because that's a huge part of, you know, how we're going to deploy stuff, is like, how do you actually lay a pad really quickly? Do we really need the rebar in that configuration? Could we use steel plate composite? Could we use like, helical versions of this? Like, what are different ways we could do that? And you have to have smart people thinking about that entire system. But it, you know, the other thing, especially for a really early stage hard tech company, is like, there's a temptation to, you know, to use the leverage of suppliers, because it's like, oh, this company makes a machine that does exactly what you want.
Yep.
But the lead time is 6 weeks. And like, what could you make that's really shitty, but in a week and a half, it got you the answer to the question that you had.
Yep.
And then you have another week and a half that you can answer the next question. And then 6 weeks later, you're like three steps further down that road. And it was way harder, used way more manual labor, it used expensive tooling, but it was faster.
Yep.
And that speed is everything.
Yep. This is a final question. What was the hardest thing that you've ever overcome?
The hardest thing I've ever overcome?
Yep.
Mm. That gets into some personal stuff, but let's do it. It's very, very hard and worth it to have children.
Mm-hmm.
My first son, Frank, we brought him home from the hospital, and I think the second night that we were with him, no, sorry, the first night that we brought him home, I randomly woke up in the middle of the night and didn't know why I'd woken up, and I just decided to check on him, and he was not breathing. He was,
oh my God,
completely not breathing. So we rushed him to the hospital, going like 90 miles an hour down like residential streets in our pajamas. Was still not breathing when we reached the hospital, and he's totally fine now. They put him on the respirator and all that kind of stuff.
And he survived?
Yeah.
How long was he not breathing?
I don't know how long he wasn't breathing before I woke up, but, from, you know, waking up to getting him into the emergency room, it was like 6 minutes, something like that.
Oh my God.
He's driving very fast.
Yeah.
That was utterly terrifying. And I was praying every single moment, that he would be okay. And, I guess I'm telling this now because I'm extremely grateful to God that he is okay. And, when things like that in your life happen, you should remember them, and you should publicly thank God that he delivered you. So that's probably the hardest thing I had to overcome. That, and then like, you know, just the, you know, the fear that comes from
jumping off the cliff of starting a company. And
yeah, just you have to leap. You have to leap into everything. When we decided to have kids, like I knew that that spectrum of things was a possibility. Like when you have kids, when you do anything hard, there's like you're exposing yourself to a spectrum of very, very difficult things. And I knew that that like that class of stuff, I didn't know that was going to happen, but I knew like that category of stuff was possible. And I would just say like overcoming the fear of simply doing it because you know it's worthwhile is really hard. But once you do it, it's
you're better for it.
You would never ever reverse it once you've done it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Isaiah.
Yeah.
It's great having you on.
Yeah. Thank you. See you.